We are crying out from the West to Europe, to the East, to the South, to everywhere for wiser leadership, better leadership, leadership that doesn't polarize, leadership that's not afraid to come to political solutions, and leadership that will continue the fight.
These days, it can feel like the world is at a true inflection point. And so this week, I'm thrilled to speak with CNN's chief international anchor, Christiane Amanpour, to get a better understanding of this current global moment. Amanpour is host of CNN International's flagship interview show and is a leading voice on how America fits into the geopolitical order. In her 40 years with CNN, she's interviewed everybody from world leaders to everyday citizens and delivered on-the-ground reports from conflict zones around the world. She specializes in helping viewers understand the human beings caught in the midst of global conflicts and how foreign policy and geopolitical shifts shape people's lives. Her groundbreaking journalism has earned Amanpour 14 Emmys, 4 Peabody Awards, and 2 George Polk Awards. And on April 12th, she'll be honored as one of the first ever Polk laureates, a short list of remarkable individuals recognized for their outstanding contributions to American journalism. Amanpour spoke with me from London between a flurry of interviews, meetings, and emails ahead of her nightly show. She offered unmatched insight into Putin's aggression in Ukraine, the appalling impact of preventing journalists from entering Gaza, and why this particular moment in world affairs keeps her up at night. I'm Charlotte Alter, senior correspondent for Time, and this is Person of the Week. You've covered conflict for over 40 years. We're talking at a moment where there's a ground war in Europe and a war in the Middle East alongside many other regional conflicts. Do you think the world is at a unique tipping point right now?
I actually do. I find it incredibly disheartening, frankly, that in 2024, we are at this place where in, let's just say, Europe, we have an old-fashioned illegal land invasion with the attempted annexation of territory of a European sovereign democratic country by an imperialist and revanchist Russia. I mean, it's hard for me even to get my head around it. And it's even harder for me to understand why 3 years in, I mean, we're in the third year now, it's a right. 2 year anniversary, we're still worrying about whether we're going to keep providing the support to Ukraine, which is the democratic sovereign nation that is where the actual battle for democracy, certainly in the Western world and in the Northern Hemisphere, is being wrought. So if we genuinely believe that all the things we've been taught from childhood and certainly from World War II on are correct moral and international values and rules of the road, then there should be no question of how to deal with this illegal invasion.
So I want to ask specifically about what's happening in Gaza as well. What do you think have been the biggest challenges of reporting on the Israel-Hamas war?
Well, the biggest challenge is, in fact, the fact that Israel does not allow any foreign correspondents into Gaza, period, end of story, unless they are handheld, embedded, or whatever else you want to say, by the IDF and get a very quick in and out, heavily directed, guided tour by the IDF. So that's a major problem. And again, it's 2024. Israel calls itself a democracy. And as a democracy, with a historically robust respect for journalism and the diversity of opinion within its own nation, is simply barring access to press from other democratic countries into Gaza. And I honestly, I've never seen anything like it in my life. I'm used to dictatorships, autocrats, you know, military juntas, you know, being very difficult in terms of giving us access. I am not used to a democracy being this obstructionist when it comes to our absolute right to tell the story. And I think that the Committee to Protect Journalists, clearly leaders of our organizations, have signed letters requesting and requiring that we be allowed access. And on top of that, we have also, certainly people like myself and correspondents, have decried the scores of dead inside Gaza, in terms of not just the tens of thousands of actual dead, but including nearly 100 journalists since October 7th in Gaza, Lebanon. And it's just, it's mind-blowing. And so it's incredibly, incredibly difficult. And I'm used to covering the human face of war. So right. I'm used to covering, even in Ukraine, you know, what's happening to men, women, and children who are not combatants. And unfortunately, so much of the wars that we see right now unfolding, including Gaza, including right. in Ukraine, are wars that are also directed at non-combatants, civilians, children, women.
So on that note, you are known for this sort of coverage of civilians and the human face of war, as you said. What is your sense of how this war in Gaza is different than other wars that you've covered in this region?
Well, first and foremost, I want to go back to October 7th, because just as I say, it's absolutely unconscionable, unpermissible, illegal in any case to attack civilians. That's what Hamas did in Israel on October 7th. Women, children, elderly were killed point blank and kidnapped, as well as those who they view as their enemies, which are Israeli soldiers, men and women. But the civilians were also targeted. This is unacceptable under any circumstance. It's a war crime. So war crimes are being committed all over. I covered war crimes, the first to emerge in Europe in my time, which was in Bosnia in the 90s. And there it was also difficult because we were deliberately targeted by one side, which were the Bosnian Serbs, promoted by Serbia, the stronger party, who wanted to ethnically cleanse and annex and seize territory for a greater cleansed Serbia. And I use those words because eventually it was a genocide, which was adjudicated as such at The Hague, and people were convicted. So that's what I've seen. And under fire, though, I was able to cover these stories along with my colleagues at great personal risk. War is very difficult, particularly wars that are directed at civilians. There's no safe place to hide, even if you're a journalist, because you're amongst the civilians by virtue of covering what's going on.
Right.
So that was dangerous, but this is impossible. We can't get in. And our colleagues from Gaza are paying with their lives to keep the world informed. You know, there are stories that are going on that, you know, we still don't even know the whole extent of it. We don't know what Hamas is up to. We don't know how the hostages are being treated. We don't know who's taking care of them. We don't know who's in charge of civil society, civil order. Apparently nobody in Gaza, because police and other sort of quote-unquote institutions in Gaza have been regularly bombed. Hospitals have been regularly bombed. Schools have been attacked and raided. And we don't know what's under the rubble. I mean, we do not know what's under the rubble. And we can't even try to find out. And it's going to be very difficult once we are granted, if we're ever granted access. In Bosnia, we could access, by and large, most of what was going on. Obviously, there were, let's say Srebrenica, for instance, was under siege, and it was very, very difficult for independent journalists to get into Srebrenica. The Bosnian Serb military wouldn't allow it, but there were ways that journalists managed to climb across mountains and go in and come out with, you know, stories at great risk to themselves. Here, you know, there's a military who are banning us and others from getting in from the Israeli side and from the Egyptian side. So Gaza has always been, ever since Hamas won those elections back in 2006, when Israel created sort of an enclave that was essentially a big prison, I have been in since, but it was always with the approval of the IDF and the Israeli government. Now you're not getting that approval as independent journalists when they don't want you to go in. As I said, they will only take you in on embeds, and that's very rare. So I just do believe that it's our responsibility as journalists to get to all these places. And we are called, you know, one of the pillars of democracy and the fourth estate. And that carries with it a responsibility and a burden to tell the full story, tell the truth, and let our viewers, our listeners, our readers, our users actually know what's going on. We are their eyes and ears, and we are unable to perform that task. So what we have right now are, you know, dedicated correspondents and producers on the outside, making whatever calls they can make into trusted sources inside Gaza and get a bit more of a picture of what's going on.
So you have been able to get into Ukraine to do some reporting on the ground there. What did you see on the ground in Kyiv?
I mean, you know, Ukraine is also not giving as much access as we would all like to the front line. And we keep lobbying the Ministry of Defense and the government to increase that access. The last time I went, I had more access than I'd had before, including into hospitals where we saw the actual wounded being evacuated. Hmm. Mostly in Kyiv, what you'll get is, as we've seen, the missile and drone attacks on infrastructure, on bridges, on electric plants, on things like that, including in some cases on civilian targets. But mostly the horrendous action, the war, is happening on the Eastern Front. And I will also say that, you know, they are not giving us as much access as we would like. But I will say it's not like you rock up on the front
right,
and sort of, you know, wander around at will. These things are always pretty much usually coordinated with the military who are actually conducting the war for all sorts of reasons, basic safety. And also, as you know, we understand that all sides sometimes want to keep certain things from the press. It's our job trying to get through that barrier. But that's one of the reasons why people don't want us sometimes near the front. And I would say in Ukraine, one of the reasons is they don't want to maybe show the world the pain that they are undergoing on the front. It's terrible. I mean, it's really, really terrible. And I don't know whether it's because they don't want to reveal the amount of death and injury. They don't want to reveal what Russia is doing to them. They don't want to maybe have a negative effect on the public morale, you know, and support for the war. And Russia is using tactics that, again, amount to war crimes. I would say that the Ukrainian officials, the president on down, have told me that even though they are outmanned and outgunned right now, as the United States refuses to unblock the military aid that Ukraine needs, even then, they are inflicting, in actual numbers, more casualties on the Russians than the Russians are inflicting on them. Mm-hmm. I mean, the president of Ukraine told me in February at Munich that it was by a significant number. I don't have it at my fingertips right now, but it's a significant number that they are imposing many more casualties on Russia. But Russia has many more people that it is just throwing into this battle without necessarily concern for whether they ever retrieve them or not, and certainly not whether they live or die.
You just mentioned that you spoke to President Zelensky this past February. What were some of the most important takeaways from that conversation that maybe didn't necessarily make it onto your broadcast, or what were your impressions of him as a person?
Well, I go back really to the eve of the war where I did my first interview with him. It was at the Munich Security Conference, and it was about 3 or 4 days before the war had started. And he had been advised by his U.S. and other allies, better not leave Kyiv right now. We know that Russia is going to invade. As you remember, the United States, Britain published that intelligence in a very unprecedented way, hoping to deter Putin. It didn't deter Putin, but they knew. The Allies knew what was happening, and they did sound the alarm. But Zelensky either didn't necessarily believe it or in any event wanted to show his face to the world and ask for the help that was required. So in February 2022, he said, this is not just my fight. It is not just Ukraine's fight. Just like in World War II, it's all of our fight. And you must come to our defense. You must support us because we are fighting for you. We are not asking for your troops. We are not asking for boots on the ground, but we are asking for the means by which to hold off an undemocratic, you know, dictatorship with imperial and expansionist ambitions, which is Putin's Russia. So fast forward now to 2 years later, you know, I noticed that he was a little down in the dumps. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the same bravado. It wasn't the same light in his eyes. 2 years of wearing military fatigues, of every night communicating with his people, of traveling around the world, you know, drumming up support for Ukraine, of speaking every day to major forums via Zoom and however else he does it, trying to keep morale up at home, trying to make sure the people on the front line have the wherewithal, which they don't really right now. They're having to ration ammunition and weapons. That's what they told me.
Right.
You know, that weighed on him. I could see that. But the fight is still there. They're not ready to give up. And he said, look, even if you do not fund us, even if we never get this bill with extra aid, we will not give up.
When we come back, Amanpour discusses journalistic freedom, what inspired her to become a reporter, and why this is an unprecedented moment in world affairs. More in a minute. So you've obviously been an outspoken advocate for journalistic freedom, even in this conversation. And recently, it was the one-year anniversary of the detainment of Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich in Russia. What are your impressions of the situation for journalists in Russia? What are the stakes here when it comes to press freedom? And what responsibility does the international community have?
Well, the international community obviously keeps supporting, when you say the international community, the Western democratic community that believes in the freedom of the press keeps lobbying, and all the advocacy groups in the United States and elsewhere do, as well as, you know, for instance, in this case, the Wall Street Journal. But anybody whose employee is in this situation works very, very hard to get them out. I know from interviews that there are ongoing conversations about prisoner swaps, about all of this kind of stuff. It just, at the moment, hasn't gotten anywhere. You know, Gershkovich was accused of espionage, and it's apparently the first time an American reporter has been accused of espionage since the end of the Cold War. It used to be de rigueur. Anybody they'd kidnap and hold hostage, imprison, they would call, you know, spies. And obviously it's rubbish in Evan's case. And they're just playing games, just like the Iranians do when they take people like Siamak Namazi, who very fortunately was released back in September. They use them as hostages and pawns. And so they try to get whatever they can out of, in this case, the United States, whether it's money, whether it's an exchange, whether it's whatever it might be. And, you know, it's a disaster. It's terrible. Yeah. But there should be negotiations. I do not believe that journalists should be just left to rot because their governments aren't going to be engaging. We know now that things have changed, that many governments have engaged. They have received their journalists and other nationals back. Sometimes it's for money, sometimes it's prisoner swaps. So it's very delicate, it's very careful, it has to be very precise, but it doesn't mean to say that you're weak if you try your best to get your citizens back, your innocent citizens back.
Yeah. So, you know, speaking of authoritarians like Putin, you and your family experienced firsthand the rise of authoritarianism with the Iranian Revolution beginning in 1978. How did that experience inform your sense of world politics and drive your interest in journalism?
Well, it certainly drove and started my interest in journalism because I was witnessing a revolution happening in my own time, in my own country, on my own, you know, front door, back door, whatever door. And I was interested by it. And I was old enough to realize that something pretty awful was happening to us.
How old were you?
I was 20 in 1978.
Okay.
And, you know, it was what motivated me to become a journalist. And I think what motivates me as a journalist, and I learned this in Bosnia, was to always be truthful, not neutral. There's often no two sides, no both-siderism in these kinds of extreme cases. And you have to call it out. And you have to be absolutely truthful and don't try to create false equivalents when none exists. But I also think that the revolution in Iran and my background as a part Western, part Iranian, part Catholic, my father was Muslim, so very multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multicultural home I grew up in, allowed me and prepared me for the kinds of conflicts that I cover now, which are by and large ethnic conflicts, religious conflicts, nationalistic internal wars. And even now, covering the Israel-Gaza war, I do my best, and I do it pretty often, to look for voices where you can find nuance within each community, mm-hmm. and look for voices of each of the different communities who are willing to engage with each other. I find that incredibly useful. I find it very affirming. I do still believe that humans, given the chance, would choose what's right, what's humane, you know, human rights, and what's peaceful. And it's very, very important for me at this time when there's so much tribalism, and I say that in a considered way, so much inability to see any nuance in any side, mm-hmm. the cancel culture that's happening right now, the inability to actually sort of go beyond the headlines and beyond the surface, the impression you get that you're forced to take sides. I disagree with all of that, and I try to go and talk to all sides.
So in your 40 years of reporting, particularly when it comes to the two regional wars that we've been discussing in Ukraine and in Gaza, can you think of a moment that compares to this one? There's a lot of people out there who say it feels like, you know, the way things were shifting before World War I, for example.
Well, I think there's two different things. I do believe in the Middle East, as we've heard, there's always been a worry since October 7th, even before October 7th, that there'd be wider regional wars. I mean, that hasn't happened, and it hasn't happened after 6 months of the most extraordinary war that's going on. As yet, we haven't seen a concerted effort by any of the regional neighbors to take full advantage and to intervene. It concerns me that the longer this goes on, the more something either deliberate or accidental could take place, and it could reverberate more regionally. In the European war, it's slightly different, because what you have here is, you haven't seen this since Hitler and the annexation of 1938 in Europe. You know, you have not seen this attack on another European country in a way that we're watching what's happening right now. And to be frank, the free world, the European world, the United States, NATO allies should have paid a huge amount more of attention when Putin started this in 2014 by fully annexing Crimea with what they hoped was plausible deniability, invading eastern Ukraine with their so-called little green men, which were in fact Russian special forces and Russian military. So that is very, very dangerous. That one affects our way of life. It really does, because it means that if Putin should be allowed to win, then the rules of the game are out the window. Where do you draw the next boundary? Where is the next frontier? Where do you say, oh no, this is the front line where we're going to defend democracy, human rights, the international rules-based order that we, the West, created, we, the United States, led after World War II? So I think that is a huge, huge drama unfolding on European soil. I do strongly believe, and most analysts will tell you this, that without a political resolution in the Middle East between Israel and the Palestinians, I'm afraid this will go on. This [S2] Yeah. [S1] Kind of periodic bloodletting will go on. And it is terribly sad, terribly, terribly sad.
So given all of your experience covering war, what is it about this moment that keeps you up at night?
Everything. This is after 40 years, 30 years of actually reporting. It's 30 years since the Rwanda genocide, for instance. I thought nothing could get bleaker than that. 800,000 to a million people were killed from April 6, 1994 in 100 days with machetes, clubs, and bare hands. I never thought I could see anything worse than that. But the accumulation of these horrors, and to see this 30 years later still happening, it really bothers me. It bothers me about leadership. I really, really do believe it's about leadership. And that's what I think is a terrible, terrible reality. 35 years since I started as a war reporter, I thought the worst of what I was ever going to see were you know, the Bosnian Serbs raping, pillaging, sniping, besieging, you know, Bosnian civilians in Sarajevo and elsewhere. And now we're seeing another worst, and it's 30 plus years later. So I put it down to leadership. Sorry, I do. I do put it down to leadership. And we are crying out from the West to Europe, to the East, to the South, to everywhere for wiser leadership, better leadership, leadership that doesn't polarize, leadership that's not afraid to come to political solutions, and leadership that will continue the fight. Like if the US, for instance, gives up now on Ukraine, what is that going to tell you about US leadership?
Christiane, it's been such an honor speaking with you about your important work reporting on these world-shaping events. But now we'd like to get to know more about some of the everyday things that shape you in a segment we like to call The Last Time. So, when's the last time a world leader hung up on you?
I think it goes all the way back to Yasser Arafat. I don't believe I've been hung up on since 2002 by Yasser Arafat, when then Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon had invaded again the West Bank and his particular compound in response to a series of suicide bombings in Israel. And I had asked him some question about responsibility and this and that, and he hung up on me in a very embarrassing way. And I don't know whether anybody around the world saw me blush, but I know I was blushing.
When's the last time you agreed to do a cameo on a TV show?
On a TV show, could it have been The Gilmore Girls?
I think so.
Which today is still resonating, and I love it. I cannot tell you the number of young women who talk to me about The Gilmore Girls. It's just so great that it's still having such an impact. And I mean, such a smart series about smart young women.
When's the last time you pulled an all-nighter?
I pulled an all-nighter. I do them quite regularly when I'm on the road, because the reality of reporting in the field for an American organization is the time change and the time difference. So often primetime shows in the US want you, and it's a ridiculous time of the morning wherever you are. So yes, I've pulled all-nighters. I don't know. The last time was maybe the last time I was in Ukraine.
When's the last time you had to do your own TV makeup?
Well, do you know, that happens more than you would like to imagine. I do it when I'm in the field. I always do that. I don't do it, at least I hope never to do it, when I'm in a studio under the full lights and the full glare, the merciless glare of studio lights. And I'm so lucky, whether it's in CNN New York or CNN London, you know, I'm lucky to have great hair and makeup artists who do a great job on me. So I'm fortunate.
Last one. When's the last time an interview left you speechless?
Let me just say, I will tell you, I was absolutely speechless when triple amputees lying in hospital just two or three days after their operations and after being withdrawn from the battlefield told me that they want to go back to the battlefield because they absolutely want to defend their country. And I'm also speechless when I talk to families of the Israeli hostages who still have family still there, or whether it's Gazans who've lost everything, including, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 members of their families, can actually speak to me with hope.
Christiane, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlotte. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You can catch Christiane Amanpour on her show, Amanpour, weekdays on CNN International and CNN Max. And if you need even more global insights over the weekend, there's also the Amanpour Hour on Saturdays on CNN. Thank you so much for listening to Person of the Week. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd love to hear from you. So send your tips or thoughts on our show to personoftheweek@time.com. I'm Charlotte Alter. See you next week. Person of the Week is hosted by Charlotte Alter. It's produced by Nina Bisbano and Allison Bailey. Our senior producer is Ursula Summer. Our story editor is Katie Feather. This episode was mixed by Joe Plourd. Our theme music was composed by Billy Libby. Joseph Frischmuth is our fact checker. Person of the Week is a co-production of Time Studios and Sugar 23. At Time, our executive producers are Dave O'Connor, Michael Erlinger, and Sam Jacobs. At Sugar 23, our executive producers are Mike Mayer, Michael Sugar, and Liam Billingham. Sasha Mathias is the head of audio at Time. You can find us online at time.com/person of the week and wherever you get your podcasts.